Okay, so I was asked to talk about the theory of jets and black holes. This is a subject, of course, in which I haven't worked actively for about 15 years, so this is a bit of the Rip Van Winkle approach. I'll tell you what I knew 15 years ago, and then what, in looking over things more recently, what's the same and what's changed. I'll say relatively little about the progress in the sort of composition and development of jets, which is actually one of the areas that solidified quite a lot recently, inspired by EGRIT, of course, the ideas of Compton drag on the bulk and internal relativistic motions suggested a way of making energy into electron-positron rest mass through pair cascades, as discussed by Blanford and Levinson and Sikora, Majeski, Biegelman, and Reese, and various permutations. And in addition to those theoretical ideas, there are also tightening observational constraints in M87 from Reynolds et al. And recent circular polarization measurements in Blazars, which again are sort of tightening the suggestions that jets are actually electron-positron. I won't say much about those because they the sort of generic features about jets sort of independent of how they're launched, and I took my task as discussing whether jets could actually come from black holes. So I'll concentrate on the ways that black holes might power jets and explain why I believe that might actually be true, despite good arguments to the contrary. So let me start with the motivations for connecting jets and black holes. There are many accretion disks that have outflows with many types of central objects that we've heard about, protostars, outflow velocities of a few hundred kilometers a second, and relative to the escape velocity of the central object, sort of ratios of 0.5 to 1. Cataclysmic variables, novae and dwarf novae, have winds that one sees in P Cygni profiles with velocities up to several thousand kilometers a second. Again, compared to the escape velocity of the central object, ratios around a half to one. And in the low-mass X-ray binaries, for the few cases where we have evidence that they're neutron stars, one sees outflow velocities are sort of a bit sub-relativistic. And again, velocities compared to the escape speed from the neutron star around a half. So all of those are suggestive of something like hydrodynamic acceleration. For example, in the solar wind, one sees outflow velocities, again, of order on average half up to one times the escape speed. Of course, in detail, we know that many of these are probably not direct, purely hydrodynamical. The cataclysmic wind, cataclysmic variable winds are probably radiation-driven. But in all of those models, it's quite natural to get velocities that are of order the escape speed. Now, if we did the same thing for the last stable circular orbit around the black hole in a standard thin disk, which hardly anybody believes in anymore, but let's take it as gospel. If we were so stupid as to try to launch the jet vertically out of the disk, then you find that the gamma beta for escape would be 0.35 for Schwarzschild black hole and 1.4 for maximal Kerr. And one should compare those to the gamma betas measured in galactic superluminal black holes, which are around 2.3. Maybe that would be consistent with a maximal Kerr. But in the AGN blazars, the typical numbers, and I draw your attention to the fact that almost all the diagrams you'll find in the literature use H0 of 100. And even the key project teams are now pushing down towards 60. So let's adopt that. The tail of the AGN blazars goes up to Lorentz factors of 15 for old-fashioned cosmologies with no lambda and omega equals 1. And if you take current fashions, you find that the Lorentz factor is going up to about 25. So even for those of us who don't like the intraday variables, I think we're already being pushed to rather higher Lorentz factors than are really very comfortable for Compton drag limits. I'll draw your attention to the fact, though, that the typical numbers are more like 4, and it really is the rare, most powerful, and most commonly studied sources which have the large Lorentz factors. So the question is, why do some AGN jets get so much higher jet velocities relative to the escape velocities than all these other accretion systems? If it's all just winds from disks, and all the disks are self-similar, then everything should end up with about the same velocities relative to escape from the inner edge. And that clearly is not happening in the more powerful AGN blazars. Now, of course, there's no shortage of theoretical ideas for getting wind velocities much larger than escape velocities. MHD effects are one nice way of doing it, with centrifugal flings, magnetic pressure gradients, conversion of pointing flux, etc. But again, if all of this is happening in disks and coronae, and they're self-similar, why don't we see that in the other systems? The second motivation is the dichotomy between radio loud and radio quiet objects of quasars with sort of similar optical infrared ultraviolet spectra, so you might imagine similar accretion disks. 10% of them have powerful radio jets, and 90% are about as pathetic as the Milky Way. arguably, inclination effects might allow many, if not all, of those 90% to have associated absorption and broad absorption line winds with velocities of maybe 0.1 c, but they one can quite clearly rule out the idea that they have relativistic jets of the type of their 10% of luckier companions. If one looks at the combination of Seyfert's narrow emission line galaxies, liners, whatever you want to call those things, it turns out that mostly those in elliptical galaxies have relativistic jets that often slow down on kiloparsec scales, but on the small scales they're relativistic. And with a few exceptions, mostly those in spiral galaxies don't do that. That suggests that there's some knob besides just the mass of the central object and the accretion rate, which would scale similar spectra, which one can turn to make a jet. And it's attractive to think about the black hole spin as one way of doing that. And finally, the point that was just raised in the question, we know that in many radio galaxies, the estimates for the kinetic luminosity of the jets made even 20 years ago were much larger than the total infrared through X-ray photon luminosity of the central object. And after GRO, we know that in many of those objects, the kinetic luminosities are actually comparable to the gamma ray luminosities, even after you correct for the solid angle that the gamma rays are probably going into only a fraction of a steradian. Of course, as I discussed in the beginning, there's compelling arguments that the gamma ray flux is probably just waste heat from the acceleration of the jet and the Compton drag on the particles accelerated in the jet. So these facts tell you that jets are not a small perturbation from some very weak magnetic field, which is just dribbling a little bit of energy out to infinity in kinetic form. In some objects, the jets are actually the dominant form of energy release. So we can try to think of theoretical reasons why accretion onto black holes might violate the similarity with other sorts of accretion disks on objects other than black holes. One obvious fact is that an event horizon around a black hole is like a sort of inside-out infinity. Material has to cross it. In the rest frame of the material, there's nothing special about the horizon, but in a frame defined at infinity, the material has to be moving in faster than all wave speeds, otherwise we would violate causality and somebody inside the black hole can wiggle something and send the signal out. That means that the black hole can do two things. One is it can swallow binding energy, and that was first pointed out in the context of radiation-supported disks, and later in the context of ion-supported disks, that one could have sort of in standard disks move the inner edge of the disk to the marginally bound from the marginally stable orbit, and you could then have an accretion disk with arbitrarily low radiative efficiency. The second point is that because material has to flow in supersonically into the black hole, there can be no pressure support on the axis of the black hole, and that means that around the black hole, there's even better reasons than in hard surface objects for supposing that there's no pressure support along the axis, and the axial region would be free of baryons. One could produce a funnel, and that might help in improving the Lorentz factor of any winds that you put in, because now you have a region which is intrinsically free of baryons except for the perturbations that you manage to get by creating particles in the vacuum or throwing them up by in some means out of the disk. And point A perhaps helps a little bit with this problem of understanding how one can have kinetic luminosities much larger than the photon luminosities, because we could have quite a large accretion rate and relatively little radiation, and if you can use the accretion to produce kinetic luminosity, the radiation will take care of itself by being swallowed down the black hole. I'll point out that this problem of getting the high Lorentz factors is a bit related to the problem that's been exercising the gamma ray burst community recently, the problem of baryon poisoning. So just to show you some old examples of funnels for constant angular momentum disks, of course you have beautiful parabolic funnels, but as one goes away from constant angular momentum towards quasi-Keplerian disks, one can construct little similarity barotropic solutions and find that the funnels open up to wider and wider cones. And in principle, if you consider only the material which is actually bound, then there are these large empty regions into which one might hope to insert winds. Now, the second nice thing about black holes, besides being able to swallow energy and keep empty regions along their axis, is that there's the possibility of extracting energy and angular momentum from a rotating black hole. And the mass of a black hole has two contributions. One is connected to the irreducible mass, or the horizon area, and the other looks just like the contribution to the rotational energy of a rigidly rotating sphere. So we can define an angular velocity of the horizon, and I'll here mostly use units for g equals c equals 1, so all masses have units of length or time as appropriate, in this case, time. And then the available free energy in the rotation is just the difference between the mass and the irreducible mass, and that goes up to 29% of mc squared for a maximally rotating black hole, and is 1/8 of the angular momentum in units of the maximal angular momentum squared for slowly rotating black holes. Again, this is a Newtonian result. You'll notice that that's comparable to the amount of energy released by accretion processes. If you recall that to spin a black hole up from non-rotating to maximally rotating takes 1.8 accretion to 1.8 times its initial mass in a thin disk, or just doubling its mass in a marginally bound disk, and those have accretion as sort of average accretion efficiencies around 15%. Here we can get out 29% of that mc squared. So there's lots of energy if we could only get at it. So let me briefly review the ways that people have proposed for getting at it. The first recognition that there was that energy, of course, came from Penrose, who pointed out that the orbits of uncharged particles inside the stationary limit, or the ergosphere, which is a small region that extends out to 2m in the equator and the radius of the horizon at the poles, within this region, the orbits of uncharged particles can have negative energy at infinity as they cross the horizon. So with great care and cleverness of dropping particles in and colliding them inside the ergosphere and letting the negative energy particle cross the horizon, and then a particle which has collided or from which it has been separated but extra positive energy escapes, one can in principle extract the energy and the angular momentum. That is possible with cleverness for sufficiently advanced civilizations, but nobody, so far as I know, has ever been able to come up with any convincing way that something as unclever as an accretion disk or radiating fluorescent light tube or anything else would be able to extract that energy. Mostly the black hole swallows more positive energy than negative energy in any simple situation without artificial cleverness. So the pure Penrose process does not look promising for extracting the energy. The second process that was pointed out shortly thereafter by Preston Tucholsky is the fact that bosonic or integral spin waves have super radiant reflection on the horizon, and one can think of that as stimulated emission from the virtual particles near the horizon. So for bosonic waves, there's an incoming wave will stimulate emission. And if we consider a wave which is varying like e to the im phi minus omega t, the time average flux into the horizon will scale like omega minus m times the angular velocity of the horizon. So for angular velocities that are between 0 and m omega h, this term is negative, so there's actually a negative energy flux into the horizon. That means that the wave is then reflected with a larger amplitude than it went in. The ingoing wave has negative energy. The bad news is that the amplification factor is much less than 1. That means that to make a black hole bomb, you need to have this reflecting sphere at infinity, and you have to bounce your wave many, many times in order to build up exponentially. And it takes a bit of effort if you remember that these are electromagnetic waves. For example, if you're making an electromagnetic bomb, you're interested in electromagnetic waves with periods of hours, and it's a bit of a struggle to get a high reflectivity out of plasma in that case. So it has been recently reproposed in the context of gamma ray bursts. The third process is really embarrassingly simple and came historically the last. That's the Blanford-Znaik idea. And here the idea is to externally impose a magnetic field on the black hole. And the black hole, of course, cannot on its own in vacuum sustain a magnetic field. The mini magnetic field in vacuum will basically be swallowed up by the black hole of order its late crossing time. But if we put some superconducting ring or accretion disk around the black hole, that currents in that ring or accretion disk can impose a magnetic field. And the black hole, which was rotating in a vacuum magnetic field, would develop electric potential differences between the different parts of the surface. And of course, an electron charge times a electric potential can have either sign anywhere. There's nothing special about the ergosphere. It's exactly the same thing that would happen with any rotating charged body. And we'll see in a minute that for any plausible magnetic fields, this E phi term is vastly larger than mc squared, so this process completely dominates the Penrose process and is not limited to the ergosphere. So just to illustrate that, if we calculate the ratio of E phi over me c squared, if we consider sort of normalizing the magnetic field to 10 to the sort of typical 10 to the 4 Gauss number, you see that this ratio is like 10 to the 15. So if you wanted the Penrose process to be important and particles to go on gravitational geodesics, you need magnetic fields less than 10 to the minus 11 Gauss, and I think nobody believes that in accretion disks. So if we look at a sort of microphysical version of the Blanford-Znaik process, which turns out not to be directly relevant, but it's quite instructive. When we start rotating a black hole, for example, in a uniform magnetic field, you find that it develops a quadrupole pattern of surface charge. And if I rotate the black hole parallel to the magnetic field, it develops positive charge in the equator at the horizon and negative charge at the poles. And there's then a quadrupolar electric field illustrated here. So these are lines of constant potential, and the heavy lines are lines of the electric field lines. So if we now started putting charges here, charges of one sign would be sucked to the equator and charges of the opposite sign would be sucked to the poles, and we'd set up current loops that would look approximately like the electric field lines. So we can now compute how much energy and angular momentum the acceleration of those charges across the horizon will produce. So if we have an axisymmetric black hole and an axisymmetric magnetic field, and then everything is time independent, and we have symmetries of both the metric and the field, d by dt and d by d phi, so there's a conserved energy and a conserved angular momentum, and those have a particle piece plus a piece from the charge and the vector potential. Now, at the horizon, there's a boundary condition on the particle velocities, which basically says that in their rest frame, there's nothing special about the horizon. So in a observer at infinity frame, this Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, for example, you get a boundary condition at the horizon. And you can write that in this form. And if you identify the energy of a particle crossing the horizon as the change in the mass of the black hole, the charge of the particle crossing the horizon is the change in the black hole's charge, and its angular momentum is the change in the angular momentum of the black hole, this term is strictly positive, so it says that the mass is larger than phi delta q plus omega h delta j. These two quantities one can show are constant across the surface of the horizon, so this just becomes the first law of black hole thermodynamics, now including the charge and potential term. Now, if we introduce test charges at some steady rate into the vacuum around the black hole, then the black hole is going to accrete this charge until it reaches some state, so there's no net current into the black hole, so the average Q absorbed will be zero. And then we can write down an expression for the mean change in the mass of the black hole, and there'll be two terms. There's a particle term and a field term. And as I said, the ratio of this term to this term is some number like 10 to the 14. So we'll neglect the Penrose term. And the remaining term then gives the rate at which mass can be extracted from the black hole. And we can calculate a maximal rate by asking how many charges can we move per unit time before they generate a magnetic field which is comparable to the one that we imposed. And that produces this limit, which will look familiar in a moment when we look at the sort of macroscopic version of the Clanford-Zmajak process. Now, the reason that picture I've described to you isn't actually directly relevant is that for any imaginable gamma ray luminosity near the black hole, or even just considering cascades of particles accelerated by the electric fields, you create so many pairs that the vacuum is completely shorted out. And so a better approximation is either the force-free approximation or, as it turns out, or a little more helpfully, the MHD approximation. So if we write down the MHD equations, again, axisymmetric, time-independent, as in the little toy example I just gave you, one has conserved energy, conserved angular momentum, conserved mass flux over magnetic flux, and so on. And along any given field line, you can eliminate all the quantities and get an algebraic equation for the flow properties. And in order to find out what the field lines are, you have to solve the relativistic version of the Grad-Shapranov equation. Now, there are two points to notice. Remember that at the horizon, material has to be flowing in, and it has to be flowing in faster than all the wave speeds. So you have to create particles somewhere outside the horizon and accelerate them into the horizon, going through all of the slow, Alphane, and magnetosonic critical points. And then you have to do the same thing if you want to have a wind extending to infinity. You have to have a bifurcation on the field line, on one side of which you have inflow and on the other side outflow, and both of them you would like to go through all the critical points. So for the field lines which cross the horizon, there are boundary conditions on the flow there. The particles have to be able to slide down the field lines so that in rest frame infinity, they look as if they cross it at the speed of light with an angular velocity equal to that of the black hole. That corresponds to a constraint on the toroidal magnetic field at the horizon. The second thing is that there's nothing special about the horizon in the particle frames. So in the Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, there is a boundary condition, very similar to the one in the little toy particle example I gave you. And finally, the third boundary condition is the flow has to be going faster than all the wave speeds, otherwise a little demon inside the horizon could send signals outside. So one can now write down expressions using these conserved quantities and the boundary conditions. One can rewrite expressions for the rate of mass extraction from the black hole and the rate of angular momentum extraction. And once again, there are two pieces. There's an electromagnetic piece, and there's a Penrose piece, both in the energy and in the angular momentum. If if you throw these last two terms away, those are the equations of the ones that were originally derived by Blanford and Znaek. One can check that those two equations make the area of the horizon increase, because you can rewrite the sum of those two as positive definite terms, so indeed those two equations guarantee that the area of the horizon always increases. Now, a few points to notice about these equations. The first point is that the magnetic terms generally dominate the energy extraction unless one puts enormous amounts of mass loading onto the field lines, which is a bad thing if you want to get relativistic flows. The second point is that throwing away these particle inertia terms is also not a very good idea, because in order to actually determine these omega Fs, you need to know something about either the particle inertia or the dissipation, and it's more convenient to consider the particle inertia, and that means you have to keep these other terms. And the third point is that the extracted power, if we're interested in extracting energy, you notice it goes as omega F times omega H minus omega F, and I haven't told you what omega F is yet. There are three limits. One is omega F equals omega H. That's the limit which gives maximum efficiency of energy extraction. You get out your full 29% of mc squared from a maximally rotating black hole, but you get out zero power, so it takes you infinitely long to remove the energy. The second limit is omega F equals zero. That, you'll notice in this term, gives the maximum transfer of angular momentum out of the black hole, but all of the power is being dissipated in the horizon. There's nothing escaping to infinity. So that limit is not very desirable. And then there's this wonderful case, omega F equals omega H over 2, which maximizes the extracted power. But if you work it out, for example, for a maximally rotating black hole, if you work at this maximum power as opposed to maximum efficiency, which gives zero power, you get out only 9% of mc squared rather than 29% of mc squared. And the fourth point to notice is that in addition to this dependence on the omega F, there's also dependence on this A phi comma theta, which is a relativist way of writing the poloidal magnetic field at the horizon. So the extracted power goes as the square of the absolute value of the magnetic field across the horizon. Notice that strictly there's no need for the magnetic field to always point in the same direction. The flux doesn't really matter, it's just the absolute squared value, although it takes some struggling to get flux functions which vary if the currents are far away, of course. Now, this function of the total power for very small rates of rotation of the black hole is quite small, since this omega F, omega H minus omega F is certainly less than omega H squared over 4, and that goes proportional to A squared. So this first term makes the extracted power small if the black hole is rotating slowly. On the other hand, if you make the black hole go towards maximal rotation, which you might think was a good thing, it turns out actually to be a bad thing, although it's probably not so important in practice. And the reason is that if we had a very strong magnetic field, as the black hole approaches A over M equals 1, in order to avoid becoming a naked singularity, it would have to completely exclude the magnetic field. And it does that even for weak magnetic fields. So here is a plot for A over M of 0.5, 0.9, 0.99, and 0.998, the famous Thorne value for a thin disk with nothing else acting on it, of the magnetic field lines, and the horizon is the circle. And you notice that for slowly rotating black hole, the field lines are almost undistorted. But as we approach maximal rotation, the black hole acts like a type 2 superconductor and excludes most of the magnetic flux. One can show, if we write down this function Fp, which I defined as the maximum possible power that you could extract electromagnetically from the black hole, divided by this asymptotic V0 squared over Gm squared, Gm over C, all squared C, so the natural dimensional number you might write down, this maximum, this turns out this is maximized for A over M of 0.82, somewhere up here. and that maximum is about 1/100th. So the dimensional quantity you might write down, you actually have to remember to divide by a dimensionless geometry factor of 100, which is important. For slowly rotating black holes, it's about 1/30 A/m². And it's coincidental, actually, that to within 0.01, this is the same value of A/m when the marginally bound orbit moves inside the ergosphere. It's coincidental. So let's discuss these problems in turn. The rate of energy extraction depended on the angular velocity of the field lines. If we considered a field line which threaded the horizon and the disk, say some large radius in the disk, so we had a little flux loop and one end of the field line is attached to plasma that had fallen into the black hole and the other end is still attached to the disk, we could make a situation like this. And if this is far out, of course, typically the angular velocity at this point in the disk would be much less than that of the horizon. So there's lots of angular momentum being transferred from the black hole into the disk, but very little power being dissipated in that field line. On the other hand, if the field lines are open, as I described, you have to have an inflow into the horizon. You would like an outflow to make a jet. There's a stagnation surface and particles created on either side of it. And you then have to move this stagnation surface around in order to consistently get an inflow and an outflow that pass through all the critical points. And if you do that, the angular velocity of the field line turns out to be an eigenvalue. And the reason is sort of sketched here, that the stagnation surface you can show has to lie between the inner and the outer light surfaces. And as you vary the angular velocity of the field lines, those move off to infinity or close around the horizon. And so there's a particular choice of omega f which allows you to get a self-consistent solution. And typically it turns out that that omega f is some number of order unity times omega h. And so one's close to the maximal efficiency of power extraction. Brian Punsley has criticized this on the grounds that, well, if the flow is flowing supersonically into the black hole, how is it possible for any information to get from the horizon to the flow at infinity to tell it how fast it should be rotating? And I believe the answer is that, of course, the flows find out not by sending plasma waves, but because GT-phi, which propagates at the speed of light, is doing the communication. There's a second point about the asymptotic properties of the wind. If the field lines are ones which are nearly radial or more slowly converging, typically most of the power comes out in pointing flux, and it's much larger than the kinetic luminosity of the particles. But if the field lines at the base are rapidly divergent and then only later become collimated, you can get most of the luminosity in kinetic form comparable to the pointing flux. Now, the next question is how much magnetic flux goes through the horizon. And I think everybody who's ever worked on this subject has realized the problem. I think it was pointed out in Blanford and Snyak. Here's my version of it, 1983. Astrophysical importance of energy extracted from black holes is directly proportional to the efficiency with which one of these mechanisms described above can maintain a strong, large-scale magnetic field above the disk while keeping the field very weak, alpha much less than one within the disk. If this state of affairs cannot occur, then the power extracted from the hole will only be a small fraction of that lost by the disk. So there's the summary of the sort of maximal extracted powers. This point has been dredged up yet again in the light of more recent simulations of accretion disk magnetic fields by Gosch and Abramovich and Livio, Ogilvie, and Pringle recently. And they point out, sort of using these formulae, that this equation would apply, and then depending on your model of what the relationship between the internal small-scale toroidal fields in the disk and the large-scale poloidal fields are, for example, in the simulations of Baldus and Hawley and Gemmi and so on, suggests that perhaps there'd be a factor H over R for a thin disk. And the point is that this number is much less than 1 if you imagine that the field threading the black hole horizon is limited to some small fraction of the internal fields that are producing the accretion disk viscosity. So we've known that for a while. Are there any ways out? Well, one way which has been advocated for a long time, I think there's a fairly complete description in Thorne, Price, and McDonald of the idea of advection. If we had a very highly conducting disk, you can imagine dragging magnetic flux in endlessly, and eventually it would build up to such a large value that it would start pushing its way out to the accretion disk, and you would reach a sort of virial theorem limit. There's sort of a nice discussion of this process, not in the context of black holes, but in the context of understanding what's happening in the inner 200 parsecs of our galaxy by Chandran, Cowley, and Morris in a recent preprint. And one can show, of course, that in the flux-pleasing limit, the ratio of the vertical magnetic field to the surface density is a constant everywhere, so the flux per unit mass is fixed. You can estimate that in the local interstellar medium, something like 5 × 10⁻⁴ Gauss centimeter squared per gram for the coherence length of about a kiloparsec, so a coherent mass of 10⁵ or 10⁶ solar masses. In the intermolecular zone, or within 200 parsecs of the center of our galaxy, that rises to about 3 × 10⁻², Gauss centimeter squared per gram. But if we ask what we need to power a powerful jet in an AGN, and we wanted to have a magnetic field that was approximately uniform from, say, 10 gravitational radii, 10m, to the horizon, you find that that would require the ratio of magnetic field to surface density of 10⁴ Gauss centimeter squared per gram, vastly larger than the ratios we know anywhere in our galaxy. I think Mitch Biegelman, I think, pointed out this problem a few years ago. So the only way around this problem is to say that, what, of course, it's not an instantaneous value, but if you extend this out to a large enough radius, eventually you could accumulate enough flux, and it would require that the magnetic field be coherent and act frozen over about 3 × 10⁴ solar masses of accreted version of the local interstellar medium, or 300 solar masses of accretion in the central molecular zone. Perhaps it's just possible. Makes you a bit nervous, though, when you realize that this flux freezing approximation requires that the magnetic Prandtl number be much larger than 1, so that the advection actually dominates over the magnetic diffusion. And you might guess in sort of naive models of magnetic turbulence that, in fact, if the magnetic turbulence is what's producing the viscosity, then you're guaranteed to get the magnetic Prandtl number of order unity. So the actual microscopic diffusivity really matters in this case. And we're looking for big factors here. Of course, I produced this diagram when I ran the ITP program here 12 years ago, so I thought I would just put it up to see how much progress we made on all the various important elements. The typeface down here indicates perhaps the solidity of the various elements. So, if one considers that the magnetic fields are being produced mostly by turbulence and balanced by magnetic reconnection, it really looks as if there's a problem producing large-scale magnetic fields, which could be important enough to extract a significant amount of power from the black hole. But, as I mentioned, it's quite hard for me to see how these very high Lorentz factors of AGN jets, which we believe are associated with black holes, could arise just out of scaling of the accretion disk from other systems we know, because the other systems don't seem to be able to produce these very high ratios of jet velocity to escape velocity. So it's perhaps worth thinking fairly hard about other ways of producing large-scale magnetic fields in the inner parts of disks. So let me just conclude with sort of a toy version of the original ion torus model for extracting energy from black holes and trying to explain why FR1s and FR2s had such high ratios of kinetic luminosity to photon luminosity. And the idea was, well, perhaps one could have most of the magnetic field being produced by a current sheet on the surface inner surface of the accretion torus. You know, I could even make this more extreme of just considering some little ring of material which had no magnetic field and then had current sheet on the inner side, which is generating most of the colloidal magnetic field threading the horizon. Then if a few of the field lines connected to that ring, one could use the energy and angular momentum extracted from the black hole to keep the currents running in the ring, and the pressure of the material outside would be what confined the ring, since it seems unlikely that you would actually have rigid body forces acting on astrophysical rings, so pressure gradients seem like a good thing. So perhaps even without any accretion at all, one could invent a sort of self-sustaining system for extracting energy from a black hole without having any accretion. You just balance the losses by a little bit of what you extract. There's recently been some controversy about whether the Cowling anti-dynamo theorem actually applies in general relativity. And there are claims by Khanna and Commonsend, I think, were the first, and more recently Agee and Nunez, that it's possible to get so-called omega-omega, lowercase-uppercase dynamos operating exclusively in this inner region near the black hole, where the extra term of the dynamo equation is coming from the GT phi part of the metric. There have been other simulations which don't reproduce Khanna and Commonsend. It looks a little bit fishy to me, but I think it's really worth thinking about as perhaps another way of generating strong magnetic fields. So I'll just conclude by saying it seems to me the crucial question on whether the black hole energy extraction is going to work is whether we can construct plausible states in which the interior of the disks are not as magnetized as the horizon. We have much stronger magnetic fields in the inner parts of the within the last stable orbits or in the so-called free fall regions and near the horizon than one does in the actual interiors of the disk. Stop there.
Well, I wonder whether one could adopt a simpler resolution of this, which is that, in fact, there is more dissipation and energy coming off the disk than from the center, but because stuff in the center has much higher Lorentz factors and maybe different particle processes operating, that's the part you see. But, in fact, there is a wind that's pumping energy into the galaxy, and it's spreading out over larger scales in a less collimated way, and you simply don't pick it up.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, if you wanted to do that and sort of still take these models, though, I think it's hard to avoid that wind that you're extracting from the disk would have a luminosity which would be hundreds of times larger than the one that would be extracted from the black hole. And even if it's only going at a third of C or something, it seems rather hard to hide something with 100 times the kinetic luminosity of your relativistic part just because it's going a bit slower. But maybe it's worth thinking about.
An alpha omega dynamo in the disk itself solves, I think, most of these problems. The big problem in alpha omega dynamos has always been that people have called turbulence. But we have a very natural coherent mechanism, and that's the star disk collision that can give rise to the broad emission problem. Then you get the magnetic fields you need around the black hole, you get enough coupling to it, you get all the energy.
I guess it does seem to me the star disk collisions would work at quite large radii. I guess does the dynamo continue to operate at the very small radii where you would want to build?
Why not? Well, yeah, you don't break up this gravitationally break up stars with some around M three or four for 10 to 8 solar black holes. So coherence exists. Right in, but you don't need to make the dynamo all the way in. You can make it out at M of 10 or 50. And then the flux is still concentrated next to the black hole. And your winding occurs somewhere in between. So I don't think you need all of this apparatus.
Any of those doing disk simulation?
Back. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a brief comment. Showed the picture illustrating just to the horizon as a function of A over M, and indeed when the black hole is not charged, the same 3D that fills the sky is the city is very safer only than the city is in your power. Could you allow for charge to raise to lose the north end of the city? It actually could be here.
I guess I'm quite surprised, I guess, because, I mean, in astrophysical situations, the charge that you can build up is really very small, I mean, compared to the dynamical field. So. Well, yeah. I mean, I guess one has to be careful about sort of lowest energy states, whether they're actually attainable in the presence of the external charges.
Well, I agree with that. And then there's another effect that the fact that the question of this, when A reaches M, of the drop to the service to M times the service of M minus A, the square root of
Yeah. No. I should have said. I think that effect is unlikely to be important in practice because if you have any electromagnetic extraction operating at all, if you have a balance between accretion and that extraction, it almost always keeps the A over M less than 0.99. In which case, this expulsion effect is at most a factor of two. So I think in practice, it's not very important unless you had some reason for considering very rapidly rotating black holes.
Any other questions? Before we break for lunch, the organizers have a few remarks. Let's thank all four speakers again for attending.